The following podcast contains audio extracted from videos on the Harry Potter Theory YouTube channel. Hey everyone, welcome to another installment of Harry Potter Theory. Today we'll be discussing a few noteworthy instances in which Wizarding World magic makes absolutely no sense. As many fans of fantasy fiction will tell you, magic tends to have different rules depending on which universe you're referencing. For example, in some fantasy realms, wizards are called warlocks and witches are called mages. In these universes, those who have magical abilities may or may not require wands. Sometimes witches and wizards solely rely on the magic they can brew in a cauldron. Other times, they ride dragons. But regardless of the differences between each of these fantasy worlds, they all have one thing in common. That is that they all have their own set of rules on how magic exists and operates. In terms of the Harry Potter universe, there are, of course, many rules and stipulations as to how magic works in the Wizarding World. But with a universe that has continued to expand over the course of two decades, it's not all that surprising that some of these rules don't really make much sense at all, and sometimes there aren't any rules to even reference. In today's video, we'll be going through 10 instances of Wizarding World magic that truly make no sense at all. Let's begin. 1. The confusing functionality of the trace. Throughout the Harry Potter series, we are introduced to the idea that young witches and wizards below the age of 17 are considered underage. While the very choice of this number seems somewhat a mystery, after all, the age of majority in most places within the Muggle world is 18, it's not so much the actual numeric milestone that I take issue with. Instead, I find the magic that's used by adult witches and wizards to monitor underage magic to be problematic. This particular spell is called the Trace, and it is used by institutions like the British Ministry of Magic to alert officials working within a department, such as the Improper Use of Magic Office. Evidently, the Trace is placed on young individuals with magical abilities and, when a spell is performed in close proximity to someone who is underage, can identify the following: what, where, and to when magic was cast. That is, the ministry can tell what spell was used, the location, due to the trace being somewhat bound to the young person, and the exact time it was cast. This is well supported throughout the novels and films, with a particularly good bit of evidence in the following letter received by Harry after Dobby the House Elf performed magic at No. 4 Privet Drive during summer holiday. Dear Mr. Potter, we have received intelligence that a hover charm was used at your place of residence this evening at 12 minutes past 9. And yet, despite all those details, we're left with many questions, like, how is the trace bound to a young witch or wizard? Who puts the spell on underage magical children? As far as we know, the ministry doesn't send officials to each and every place of residence within Wizarding Society to bind the trace to young witches and wizards. Nor is there any mention of someone from the ministry visiting magical schools like Hogwarts to do a mass incantation of the spell. I suppose parents could perform the trace upon having a child, kind of like how Muggles register their newborns with governments, but what about Muggle-born children? Their parents wouldn't know how to do this. Some fans have suggested that perhaps students get the trace upon boarding the Hogwarts Express for the first time, but what about children who don't go to school, like Merope Gaunt? To me, this doesn't add up. Every underage magical child has the trace. We just don't know where it comes from. Even more confusing still, there's the question of how the ministry would be able to identify if underage witches or wizards were actually using magic outside of school. For example, if someone with the trace on them were to use a spell at their house, wouldn't the Improper Use of Magic Office just assume that it was a parent casting magic? For if they didn't, there would be a lot of alerts they would need to unnecessarily respond to each and every time a senior member of a child's house performed magic. Of course, doing so would be completely unsustainable, not to mention rather impossible. The same could be said for basically everywhere outside of school within the Wizarding World as well, from shopping in Diagon Alley to attending Quidditch matches. With so many witches and wizards, how would ministry officials be able to identify if any of the magic they detected through the trace was from an underage witch or wizard, or someone of the age of majority who was simply standing near an underage witch or wizard? It seems to me that the trace is only really effective for Muggleborns, as it would be obvious who set off the trace if a young witch or wizard with Muggle parents used magic. This particular scenario is described in the following scene between Mad-Eye Moody and Harry Potter in The Deathly Hallows. Second problem, you're underage, which means you've still got the trace on you. The trace, said Mad-Eye impatiently. The charm that detects magical activity around under-17s. The way the Ministry finds out about underage magic. If you or anyone around you casts a spell to get you out of here, Thickness is going to know about it, and so will the Death Eaters. The final issue that I have with the trace is the way it's portrayed as having one singular use, to track underage witches and wizards doing magic. But if the Ministry has been able to use the trace to monitor children, don't you think they could have, or should have, applied the same principle to criminals? For example, the trace could be used to track people released from Azkaban to ensure that they're not casting unforgivable curses or committing further crimes. So why is the Ministry more concerned with a bunch of kids learning magic than they are with actual criminals? 2. Veritaserum's lack of use in law enforcement. Veritaserum is a powerful truth potion that we learn about in the Goblet of Fire when Professor Severus Snape explains the following to a group of 4th-year Hogwarts students. It is Veritaserum, a truth potion so powerful that 3 drops would have you spilling your innermost secrets for this entire class to hear. Now, the use of this potion is controlled by very strict Ministry guidelines, but unless you watch your step, you might just find that my hand slips, right over your evening pumpkin juice. And then, Potter, then we'll find out whether you've been in my office or not. As described by Snape, Veritaserum is highly controlled by the Ministry of Magic, suggesting that the wizarding government is in possession of the majority of this potent potion. So why is it then that the Ministry doesn't use Veritaserum to solve crimes or identify murderers? The most obvious example of how the potion could be used by the Ministry was Sirius Black's murder trial, or lack thereof. For not only was Sirius not asked for his side of the story, which would have been irrefutable had he shared it under the influence of Veritaserum, he wasn't even given a proper trial for the crimes he was accused of, namely the mass murder of many muggles and aiding Voldemort in finding the Potters, which led to James and Lily's deaths. However, if the Ministry had simply administered, what was it, just 3 drops of Veritaserum, he could have pointed out the actual murderer, Peter Wormtail Pettigrew. Of course, with this logic, Veritaserum could be used to help the Ministry of Magic solve all sorts of crimes. So why isn't it used? 3. Voldemort's interest in the Elixir of Life. The Elixir of Life shows up in the very first installment of the Harry Potter series, and is described in great detail through passages like the following. The ancient study of alchemy is concerned with making the Philosopher's Stone, a legendary substance with astonishing powers. The stone will transform any metal into pure gold. It also produces the Elixir of Life, which will make the drinker immortal. There have been many reports of the Philosopher's Stone over the centuries, but the only stone currently in existence belongs to Mr. Nicolas Flamel, the noted alchemist and opera lover. And so, as an item of incredible rarity and value, it wasn't all that surprising when the Philosopher's Stone was the first thing we ever saw Voldemort go after, aside from unicorn blood, that is. And at the time, the Dark Lord's interest in the stone and its Elixir of Life made perfect sense. Here was a wizard who had lost his corporeal form and who had always been obsessed with immortality. The Philosopher's Stone seemed the perfect solution for a bloke like that. But as the series went on, we learned that Voldemort had long since created multiple, 7 to be exact, Horcruxes in a somewhat successful attempt to make himself live forever. Indeed, it was this exact dark magic that allowed him to evade death when he was hit by his own ricocheted killing curse the fateful night he tried to murder Harry Potter as an infant. So why would he want or need the Elixir of Life? He was already immortal enough through Horcruxes. Now, I know what you're thinking. Maybe the Philosopher's Stone could have given him a new body. But that's not what the Elixir of Life was known to do. In my opinion, it's more likely to have kept him immortal in his shadow form, as we learn later on in the series that, in order to get his body back, he needed a dark arts ritual like the one performed with Wormtail's help in the Goblet of Fire. So, to me at least, Voldemort's interest in the Elixir of Life doesn't really make much sense at all. 4. The paradoxes of the Time Turner. When the Time Turner first showed up in the Prison of Azkaban, it, without a doubt in my mind, became the most problematic bit of magic in the entire series. Disproportionately to its size, this little hourglass caused some very big problems in terms of plot holes and canonical contradictions. Of course, when we first learn about the device that Hermione's been wearing around her neck like a piece of jewelry, it seems harmless enough. Hermione has used its powers to complete a course load that shouldn't be possible within the constraints of actual time. Typical Hermione. But then, larger questions come to mind. if one can simply go back in time, why not go back and fix mistakes or save those who've died? Harry could go back and save his parents, or later, Sirius Black, Dumbledore, and even the fallen members of the Order of the Phoenix. Or why not go back and simply take down Voldemort before any of those deaths even happened? The explanation meant to rectify these major narrative issues was the introduction of the concept that one would age the amount of time travelled backward. So if you travelled back a decade, you would age that number of years upon returning to your current time. However, I find it hard to believe that Harry wouldn't have given up 10 years of his life in order to go back and prevent the murder of his parents. Not to mention all the time travelling that Hermione did to keep up with her course load in her third year. By all accounts, I think she should have looked at least a little bit older by the end of The Prisoner of Azkaban. And clearly, author J.K. Rowling realised how problematic the time turner became, sharing with fans on WizardingWorld.com, "I went far too lightheartedly into the subject of time travel in Harry Potter and The Prisoner of Azkaban. While I do not regret it, Prisoner of Azkaban is one of my favourite books in this series, it opened up a vast number of problems for me, because after all, if wizards could go back and undo problems, where were my future plots? I solved the problem to my own satisfaction in stages. Firstly, I had Dumbledore and Hermione emphasize how dangerous it would be to be seen in the past, to remind the reader that there might be unforeseen and dangerous consequences, as well as solutions in time travel. Secondly, I had Hermione give back the only time turner ever to enter Hogwarts. Thirdly, I smashed all remaining time turners during the battle in the Department of Mysteries, removing the possibility of reliving even short periods in the future. So obviously, the possibilities presented by the existence of the time turner created some pretty troubling issues. 5. The Patronus Charm's difficulty level. Aside from a few of the most famous spells, like Wingardium Leviosa, Expelliarmus, and Avada Kedavra, Expecto Patronum is probably among the most well-known incantations within the wizarding world of Harry Potter. And as many of you will know, it is the spell that casts the Patronus Charm, the potent spell heavily featured in The Prisoner of Azkaban. But if you're feeling a little fuzzy on the details of this particular charm, here are the need-to-know basics. Expecto Patronum can produce a non-corporeal or corporeal variation of the Patronus Charm. The non-corporeal version typically resembles wisps of silver, which is most likely to occur when a witch or wizard is first learning the spell. The corporeal form, on the other hand, is that of an animal in a silvery, vapor-like state. The animal is unique to the individual and relates to their personality and emotions. In most cases, the animal will remain the same over the course of a witch or wizard's life, but it has been known to change in the event of a traumatic or life-altering event. The following is an excerpt from The Prisoner of Azkaban, in which Professor Remus Lupin explains to Harry Potter how a Patronus works, in that it is a kind of anti-dementor, a guardian which acts as a shield between you and the dementor, a kind of positive force, a projection of the very things that the dementor feeds upon, hope, happiness, the desire to survive. But it cannot feel despair, as real humans can, so the dementors can't hurt it. And so, in order to produce one, a witch or wizard must focus all their energy on a single, very happy memory. It is through this thought or memory that the charm is conjured, and more specifically, what makes it such a potent spell against dark magical beings like dementors and letherfolds. Of course, the catch is that the presence of these beings, especially dementors, literally suck all the happiness from the room. This makes performing the Patronus charm extremely difficult when faced with a dementor, as focusing on happy thoughts when this emotion is being ripped away from your body comes with some logistical issues. However, in the series, we see a number of characters struggle to conjure this spell even when there are no dementors present. In my opinion, this makes little to no sense. For surely, it wouldn't be all that difficult to simply think about your happiest thought at some random moment and yell the words Expecto Patronum, would it? Surely not, as we see Harry easily cast the full force of his Patronus at a group of Slytherin students merely pretending to be dementors, even though, at the time, he was still struggling to conjure the spell when up against actual dementors. 6. The invention of new spells. The idea that spells could be invented was a new concept introduced in The Half-Blood Prince. In this book, we discover that Snape was not only incredibly talented at potion making while he was a student, we also learn that he invented many spells while he was attending Hogwarts. Having created at least 7 spells during his youth, the most noteworthy one is a curse called Sectum Sempra, which lacerates its target, causing severe bleeding. In the following excerpt from the 6th novel, we see the exchange between Harry and Professor Snape, in which Severus admits to being the creator of the spells Harry had discovered in his textbook. "You dare use my own spells against me, Potter? It was I who invented them. I, the Half-Blood Prince. And you'd turn my inventions on me, like your filthy father, would you? I don't think so. No." While the idea that new spells can be created is an exciting one, I think it presents quite a few problems in terms of the laws of magic. Basically, what's required to create new charms or curses? Are there parameters or limitations? Of course, it seems to be rather dangerous work, as proven by the accidental death of Luna Lovegood's mother, who died while experimenting with new spells. But if a student at Hogwarts could create curses so harmful and powerful as the one Snape invented, it's probably quite accessible. So why weren't new spells created all the time? For example, why wouldn't Voldemort have simply created a murderous curse even more powerful and potent than Avada Kedavra? Or why didn't Harry invent some spell to specifically take down the Dark Lord? 7. Transfiguration's questionable ethical nature. Transfiguration is a discipline of study at Hogwarts and other magical schools that teaches the art of transforming one thing into another, conjuring, vanishing, and more. For the most part, this particular branch of magic, while rather difficult to master, appears to be rather straightforward. Witches and wizards who are skilled in transfiguration can transform an inanimate object into something else, conjure certain items, and even make things disappear. All of this seems rather benign, until the objects being transformed are living creatures. For example, does anyone know what happens to the biology or sentience of a dog who is turned into, say, a broom? What about if you turn a teapot into a cat? Does the cat have the ability to think, even though it was originally a teapot? And what about if you turn the cat back into a teapot? Does it lose its brief abilities to think, feel, and be alive? Then there's the matter of the actual transformation. When transfiguration magic is cast, does the target of the spell feel pain? What happens if the spell is performed incorrectly? Does a living being become permanently disfigured, or worse? Sadly, I believe so, as according to the following text from Emmerich Switch's A Beginner's Guide to Transfiguration. "Incomplete transfigurations are difficult to put right, but you must attempt to do so. Leaving the head of a rabbit on a footstool is irresponsible and dangerous. Say, reparaphage, and the object or creature should return to its natural state." So, with all that in mind, the art of transfiguration seems to become a lot more ethically questionable, does it not? I mean, a decapitated rabbit must be in extreme pain, and since sometimes transfiguration spells are permanent, and other times they are not, there's even more reason to second-guess the usage of this particular branch of magic on living creatures. 8. The homunculus charm's lack of use in law enforcement. While you may not immediately recognize the name of the homunculus charm, odds are you know of at least one magical item that uses this particular bit of magic. For the homunculus charm is the spell that James Potter, Sirius Black, Remus Lupin, and Peter Pettigrew used to create none other than the Marauder's Map. Despite the general mischievous nature of the map, it's not the item itself that is responsible for its incredible ability to track each and every living and ghostly being on the grounds of Hogwarts. That is actually the homunculus charm, a spell so formidable that it's even able to show individuals who are in their animal animagus form or hidden by magical artifacts like the Cloak of Invisibility. So, knowing just how powerful and effective the homunculus charm is, and the fact that a group of young students were able to perform it quite effectively, why isn't this spell used more often? To me, it seems almost insane that a charm such as this wouldn't be leveraged by, say, the school itself, to track down mischief makers and keep the castle safe from intruders. Even more obvious than that, shouldn't the Ministry of Magic be leveraging a spell like this to monitor areas that are susceptible to the wizarding world's greatest risks? A few locations that come to mind are Gringotts Wizarding Bank or Azkaban Prison. And yet, for some strange reason, the one and only time we see this charm in use is within the mischievous folds of the Marauder's Map. 9. Animagi's Registration Requirements. Over the course of the series, despite there being fewer than 1,000 in existence, we meet several animagi. These are witches and wizards who can transform themselves into an animal counterpart at will. And unlike a person's Patronus, The form of an individual's animagus cannot be influenced by emotion or experiences, and therefore can never be altered. And so, as each animagus has a specific animal that they can transform into, witches and wizards are asked to register their animagus ability and animal type with the Ministry of Magic's Animagus Registry. Failure to do so has often resulted in imprisonment in Azkaban. Now, while I understand the reasoning behind a registry, known animagi would be less likely to get away with criminal activity in their animal form. I do feel that imprisonment for failure to register seems a bit much. This is particularly so in consideration of the fact that animagi seem to have been singled out in this way. For example, why aren't legilimens, or mind readers, as us muggles would call them, asked to register with the ministry? Shouldn't all extraordinary magical abilities be treated the same? 10. The inconsistency of incantations. Lastly, on today's list, we'll be covering incantations and the overall inconsistency with their linguistic morphology. Here's what I mean. Many spells that we learn about in this series are general commands. Accio, the spell that summons an item or object. Wingardium Leviosa, the levitation spell that can lift any object up into the air. Lumos, a charm that brings light. And Expelliarmus, the defense spell that removes a weapon, most often a wand, from another person. But not all incantations are this general, and for no apparent rhyme or reason, certain spells are oddly specific, like Slugulus Erecto, a spell that's used to induce the vomiting of only slugs. Oculus Reparo, a charm that specifically fixes glasses. And Densorgio, a hex that induces the growth of teeth. In all three of these examples, it seems incredibly confusing, at least to me, why they are so specific. For shouldn't Slugulus Erecto actually be Erecto, a general vomiting spell that you could then tack whatever you wanted onto the end, saying something like Erecto Slugs or Erecto Boogers? After all, this is how spells like Accio are used. The same way of thinking could then be applied to Oculus Reparo and Densorgio. Both these spells would make a lot more sense if they were Reparo and Yu-Gi-Oh for repair and grow, respectively. With so much inconsistency within the structure of the Wizarding World's incantations, I'm left wondering if there was any reasoning behind how these spells were created at all. And with that, we've come to the end of another video. What did you think? Did I miss any major examples of Wizarding World magic making no sense? Share your thoughts in the comments below, and as always, if you enjoyed this video, don't forget to like it and subscribe to the channel. Also, be sure to check out the content on Spotify, as well as extra content on my second channel, Harry Potter Theory Extra. Until next time, remember, it does not do to dwell on dreams, and to forget to live.